University of Chicago's Richard Thaler won the Nobel Prize in Economics on Monday for his work that shows people aren't as rational as most economists think.
One of his main influences is a behavioral psychologist named Daniel Kahneman, and he made the joke that I don't know anything that a good used car salesman doesn't.
We explore how influential Thaler's career has been, not just for the field of economics. Plus, Chicago writer Mark Kosicki's novel Afterlife is a thriller and a love story about what happens after we die.
I don't want to give away spoilers, but it's sort of nested like Russian dolls, with life as the center of things and various stages that come after that aren't at all what the protagonist expected.
And you may have noticed the blue posters with the words "Hate has no home here" popping up all over the place. We revisit our conversations with Seiki and the Chicago-based creators of that campaign, which is spread not just across the state, but the world. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the 2017 Nobel Prize winner in economics, Richard Thaler.
Thank you very much. I'm pretty sure this is the first time that the president, provost, and dean have had a conversation about me in which the phrase "pain in the ass" was not mentioned, for which I'm grateful. Although I'm sure that is not a forecast of future behavior.
Earlier this week, the Nobel Prize for Economics went to University of Chicago professor Richard Thaler. Thaler's work is known for bridging economics with human behavior, something he brought to the masses in his best-selling book, Nudge. He also appeared in the 2015 movie The Big Short, delivering what has to be one of the most memorable economics tutorials in history with the help of who else? Selena Gomez.
Well, here's Dr. Richard Thaler, father of behavioral economics, and Selena Gomez to explain.
Okay, so here's how a synthetic CDO works. Let's say I bet $10 million on a blackjack hand.
$10 million because this hand is meant to represent a single mortgage bond. Okay, Selena has a pretty good hand here, showing 18, dealer showing 7. That's a really good hand for Selena. Good odds. In fact, her chances of winning this hand are 87%.
So, my odds are good. I'm on a winning streak. Everybody in this place wants to get in on the action. How could I lose, right?
Now, this is a classic error.
It's safe to say Richard Thaler is not a conventional economist, but that's precisely why the Nobel Committee honored him for his pioneering work in establishing that people are predictably irrational or predictably dumb, as my guest would put it. Wet Moser is an associate editor at Chicago Magazine. His recent piece is called "How Richard Thaler Won a Nobel Prize for Studying the Dumb Stuff People Do." Hey, Wet, welcome to the 21st.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So I want to get to his theories in a second, but first, you wrote in your story the scene, sort of the day of the announcement, and I feel like very few people get to hear about what it's like to win a Nobel Prize. How did it happen for Richard Thaler? This was Monday, right?
Yeah, this was Monday morning, and he got a call at 4 o'clock in the morning, Central Time, and they told him that he had to not tell anyone for an hour, and his reaction was, well, who am I going to tell at 4 o'clock
in the morning.
And then he had to do a press conference, and then obviously he had to take calls from a lot of members of the press because stories were, you know, already coming out by 8, 9 in the morning where he'd been talking to reporters. And then he had to go into work and do a big press conference with the dean and members of the faculty at the Booth School where he teaches.
Right. And of course, the Booth School, this is not a new drill for them, having Nobel Prize winners, right?
Yeah. Eugene Fama, so Nobel laureate, was in the front row.
Yeah. So this is not a new thing for the University of Chicago. What is a new thing, and I think it particularly for different people who win the Nobel Prize, was his answer for what he was going to do with the prize money. First of all, 1.1 million kroners? Is that how much?
I believe that's correct.
His response, I loved what he's going to do with the money. What did he say?
He started by talking about how every Nobel laureate gets this question. And it's true. And they get it over and over again. And it's usually one of the first questions that they get. a lot of economists would consider this to be sort of a dumb question because money is fungible, is the way that he put it. That, you know, if he's spending money on vacation or educational program or whatever he went, whatever he's doing with the quote unquote Nobel money, is that the Nobel money or is that money from his job or from his book sales? It's all, you know, coming from the same pot theoretically. But he said, you know, this to me is not as dumb a question for me as it would be for other economists because he does something that he calls mental accounting. This is actually a pretty famous concept that he originated, which is that depending on where your money comes from, you put sort of different values on it. You know, you set aside money from different things to do different things. So he said that whenever I do anything fun with the money that I have, I'm going to say it's from the Nobel Prize.
Right. And that's actually a really good explanation of his theories and his he's one of the basically sort of one of the fathers of behavioral economics. And if anyone has read the book Nudge, it's super approachable. In my former career as a business reporter, when I first read it, I really enjoyed it because it was so different than a lot of the other things I had read. And what I love about Nudge, wait, you kind of talk about this a little, and this is Richard Thaler's thing, that the world is kind of divided into two people, right? There are people who basically make decisions like Homer Simpson, and then there are people who make decisions like economists.
Yeah, that's sort of one way of looking at it. And people sort of do those things to various degrees.
Right.
That kind of the worldview that Thaler's work is really challenging, which was something that was much more prevalent in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, was this idea that people sort of on the whole behave rationally.
Right. But the idea was that they always thought people act in their best interests all the time.
Well, it sort of evens out to that. Like, think of it like when you're at a concert and everyone is singing along. And if you have 10,000 people singing along, it usually sounds pretty good, even though the, you know, 5-10 people around you sound terrible. Everyone kind of evens out that the people who are, you know, singing too high or too low or behind the beat or ahead of the beat, that it sort of distributes out so that it all kind of sounds like the song is supposed to sound.
Right. And his point is it actually doesn't necessarily do things that way.
Yeah, that there are certain failures of what economists consider rationality that you can predict and that people can be expected to do in the same way at the same time.
I wonder if we could talk about a little bit more of some of the examples of his work in everyday life. Like there's, for example, like a concert ticket, and there's a sort of a theory that he has about how much we value things. It goes back to what he said about the prize money, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so one of the, when he was a young academic, kind of how he got started in the field of behavioral economics was that, you know, he was at Rochester and they were extremely believed in sort of the rational models. And he started kind of looking at how individuals violated these assumptions. He called it dumb stuff people do. Regular people, it might not actually sound dumb, but for economists,
they thought it was
dumb.
Right.
And one of his examples was that he and a friend got tickets to a basketball game. They were given tickets to a basketball game, and there was a blizzard, and they didn't go. And later, his friend said, you know, if we had bought those tickets, then we probably would have gone because they had put money towards it, which maybe...
So then they valued it more.
Yeah, they valued it more, which, you know, should make... It seems intuitive to most people.
Normal people.
Yeah, but an economist would say, well, either way, you have the tickets. And the fact that you bought them or were given them, that doesn't matter anymore. They have the same economic value to you when they're in your hand. So it would be silly to not go if they were free, but to go if
you
paid for it.
Right. Nudge is actually a really interesting example of this because he talks about different theories, right? So like, for example, if you in a cafeteria had a choice between putting healthy food at sort of kids' eye level, we can structure decisions in a way that kind of help people make better decisions for themselves in their lives. Mm-hmm. And this was something actually, when it came out, it got a lot of a notice, especially from the Obama administration during the campaign, right?
Yeah, the Obama administration and David Cameron, the UK prime minister. Mm-hmm. It was actually one of the things that came up during the press conference was sort of funny how he ended up picking it up is that people sort of around him had read Nudge and really liked it. So they kind of left copies sort of around so that he would see it. So
kind of a nudge, yeah. In other words, right?
Yeah, and so a lot of policy experts have sort of picked up the lessons from Nudge, and yeah, the Obama administration is just one of them.
Right. So actually, there was the Obama administration actually established a unit within government to study this. The British government did the same thing. Mm-hmm. So how does this kind of, I wonder how we see examples of this now that we think about things a little bit differently, thanks in part to not just Richard Thaler, there's a whole field now of behavioral economics. How does this think about the way we structure things? I'm thinking in particular like the new savings plan that was just introduced in Illinois for retirement savings.
The tier 2 versus tier 3
exactly.
Pension plans. The state of Illinois, in order to reduce the amount of money that we spend on pensions, is trying to get people into what they call the tier 3 pension system. And it's a hybrid between a regular defined benefit pension system where, you know, it's like an old school pension system where you work and then you get a certain amount of money every year after you retire. It's a hybrid between that and a defined contribution system, which is like a 401k. New employees have the choice to either do tier 2, which is a standard pension plan, or this hybrid. The state obviously wants to get more people into tier 3. So you're defaulted into tier 3 and you can choose to go into tier 2. But one of the things that Thaler has revealed, and again, this is another thing that seems obvious. One of the criticisms of Thaler is that a lot of the stuff he does is kind of obvious.
Maybe not to other economists, but yes.
But to regular people.
Let's make that the important distinction, right?
One of his main influences is a behavioral psychologist named Daniel Kahneman. And he made the joke that I don't know anything that a good used car salesman doesn't. And a lot of the stuff that Thaler has pointed out are things that businesses and salesmen know, but economists haven't really thought of. And so, yeah, it seems obvious that if you set the default for your retirement plan, something a lot of people don't think about, especially, you know, young people, if you're, you know, 22 years old coming into your first job, it might just get buried in other stuff. So whatever you're defaulted into is what you're going to do. And you see a lot of private companies that are doing this now that are defaulting people into 401k programs. And this has actually raised the sort of the savings of people by billions of dollars. You can see the percentage of people that are enrolled in 401ks like doubling and tripling within companies. And it's one of those things that just seems really obvious and is really obvious, but he was the person who pointed it out. And it's really just been a huge sea change in how people deal with their money.
You know, all of this now is stuff that we kind of that are becoming or that are pretty much part of the mainstream. And I think mm-hmm. we think about this a lot more. Fans of public radio and podcast and like Planet Money and the podcasts have gone into a lot of detail about this. But his work was really far against the grain from so many people when he actually started. Right. I mean,
right.
When we think about when he started, I feel like the irony is we think about University of Chicago's economics department is perhaps best known as the place where Milton Friedman found mm-hmm. his home. And this is kind of nerding out here on economic theory, but I wonder if you could describe what the juxtaposition is to go from Milton Friedman to Richard Thaler.
Yeah, well, the University of Chicago and also the University of Rochester, where Thaler got his PhD, were sort of on the pretty far end of believing that markets are rational and that you can base economic theory off sort of the assumption that people on the whole are rational economic actors. This was, you know, especially prevalent at the University of Chicago in the 1960s and 1970s when it really went to sort of the far end of believing in efficient free markets. Thaler, arguably one reason why he ended up at their business school as opposed to their economics department, is that he was kind of on the outside of the economic establishment. And because he was sort of started out by poking little holes in the assumptions that economists would make, and that got on people's nerves.
It got on people's nerves, and there's kind of a funny story about him joining the University of Chicago faculty in 1995. His official title is the Charles R. Walgreen Distinguished Service Professor of Behavioral Science and Economics at the Booth School of Business. Can you tell us the story behind that endowment?
Oh, yeah. So the Charles Walgreen, you know, part of the Walgreen family of Walgreens, his daughter went to the University of Chicago. And I forget exactly when this was. I believe it was like the 1930s. It was a long time ago. And he was afraid that his daughter was essentially being taught to be a communist at the University of Chicago. So he, you know, challenged the university. They ended up going to court. He lost. And he ended up sort of endowing this chair as kind of a make good for, for how he had bothered the University of Chicago.
Right. Which leads us, ironically, to Richard Thaler now. Richard Thaler, who University of Chicago's Booth School of Business and now Nobel Prize winning economist as of this week. Wet Moser is the associate editor of Chicago Magazine. We'll tweet out his article with a little bit more about this if you're interested. Hey, Wet, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st and listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today, we're revisiting a conversation I had this summer with Chicago author Marcus Seiki. Afterlife is the newest novel from the Chicago writer. He's prolific. His most recent work includes the Brilliance Trilogy. That's a science fiction action world where 1% of the population has genetically mutated abilities. In Afterlife, we have an entirely new world that reimagines what happened after we die. As a fast-paced thriller and a love story, it's set in Chicago. It's already being turned into a film from Imagine Entertainment. That's Ron Howard and Brian Grazer's production company. Marcus is writing the screenplay for that, too, by the way. Marcus stopped by our Chicago studios to chat. Hey, Marcus, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
So the idea from this book came from a dream, or maybe you would describe it more of a nightmare?
It wasn't a nightmare at first. At first, it was just a dream. I was in downtown Chicago in the dream, and it was empty. It was abandoned. And in that dream way, I knew that it was abandoned because I was dead. Everyone else actually was there. I was the one who was set aside. But it wasn't scary in itself. It wasn't a frightening dream. It was just kind of an interesting one until I woke up and I was laying in bed with my wife, you know, my partner of 20 years, and I was imagining being in the same city as her, the same place, the same room, and not being able to interact with her at all.
Wow.
And at that point, it became a
that
nightmare. Yeah.
Right.
And that it came with the kind of juice where it's like, well, I have to do something with that.
When was that?
The initial season that was a couple of years ago. It's been kicking around in various forms.
Okay.
This one was a tough book for me to write.
Well, a tough book for you to write, and I want to get into that, but let's just talk about the story, because it's kind of crazy, and I mean that in the best way possible.
Excellent. Crazy we like.
It's so different from your other work, like The Brilliant Saga, and I think it was the second chapter where I just had to stop, and there's no spoilers here, but the main character, Will Brody, dies. And I just thought, what is happening? Marcus just killed off his main character. And then it just goes somewhere where I entirely did not think it was going to go.
Good.
There's a lot of layers to this story. And I mean that literally in the book as well as metaphorically. I mean that in a lot of ways. So how hard was this to write? Because you're writing the story about a world and then other worlds, and there's still like the heart of this plot is a mystery, but then there's also a love story.
It's a lot of elements at once. I sort of decided that on this, I'd rather just leave it all on the field than feel like I held back at all. But more than anything, it's a love story to me. It's a love story about two people who won't let even death get between them. And I got to invent the afterlife, which I highly recommend. It's a great exercise for an afternoon, is inventing your own afterlife. And in my version, it's sort of... I don't want to give away spoilers, but it's sort of nested like Russian dolls, with life as the center of things and various stages that come after that aren't at all what the protagonist expected.
So there are ghosts, there are vampires in this afterlife. Vampire isn't the right word.
It's not. There are,
like, I guess we maybe call them. They're like energetic vampires or spiritual vampires. Like, they're not like actual.
Oh, that sounds like such a mishmash. That sounds awful. I would never read a book with energetic vampires.
No, I mean like around energy as opposed to drinking blood. Yeah. Where did, I guess before we get into the world that you created, when I was reading this, I was thinking, when Marcus was a kid, like, what did he learn about hell?
How messed up was this man?
I was just curious about that.
To me, what I wanted to do was create a vision of an afterlife that, while not scientific at all, it was sort of in the neighborhood of something you could buy as science, and sort of an altered reality, with the idea being that the energy that we have that is life, that is the power to create and fall in love and write poetry, that energy doesn't just vanish. It kind of fades away in these increasing steps. And then because I write thrillers and there have to be knife fights and, violence, that energy can also be taken from you in these afterworlds. And so there are people there who were normal people and found themselves in this space and decided that they would rather do whatever they wanted to for power and life and sensation.
And so there's a really interesting concept in your book that was fascinating to me, which is that those people who want to sort of take the bad energy then kind of feed off that in the world. So when we have events like terrorist events where everybody's afraid or, I'm just thinking of the state that we're in right now in our country where we've had a lot of things that have made people very angry or very nervous. In your book, that's something that, like, people are not entities are actually feeding off of. Is that
and creating
and yeah. And they're responsible for creating it too. Yeah. Where did that come from? That cool idea of yours.
Well, that came from wanting answers for how some of these things are happening. And I've always been fascinated by mythology. Myths were our way to try and put an answer to something, even if you didn't believe it. I mean, the great thing about myths is they can be true without being real. They can have kind of an inner truth. And what I wanted to do was come up with an answer for why some of the craziest of the things in our world happen, the things that they just didn't seem to before. Maybe that was just a matter of culture and reporting, but it didn't seem to be common, used to be common for people to walk into a movie theater with an automatic weapon, or just these, the more horrifying examples of bad human behavior. And so for me, it was interesting to imagine that that they were being influenced by worlds beyond what we could see.
And so there's a passage that you have that I wanted to read where you say, perhaps the truth is that hell wasn't a physical location. Hell had been created countless times before. It was almost an equation to it. Hell was born when some decided others weren't people.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's also there's a really interesting and very strong sense of morality throughout all of this also about the way that we treat people and the consequences that has, regardless of whether they're living or dead.
That's central to me. I mean, for all of this, in a lot of ways, it's a very simple parable if you pare down some of the elaborations. It's you can roll over other people and take from them, and you can benefit doing that. But you become something less than human. And Within the book, I compare that to the uber wealthy who, you know, just take and take and take and don't care. And that extended into my afterlife is it's really the same sort of action.
And so how did you prepare for this? Because in your past books, you've done super cool things like be with SWAT teams. And like, just, how do you prepare for writing a book about the afterlife in Chicago being – because I love the scenes of walking around Chicago being abandoned. And this is a city that's not often abandoned. So did you walk around the Loop like on a Saturday afternoon? Or how did you figure out – how to do this
one was more than anything an intellectual exercise. A lot of the research I've done, like hanging out with SWAT teams and diving for pirate treasure and stuff, that's so I can get the physical details right. This one, I spent a year wandering around just kind of imagining wherever I was, whatever I was doing at that moment, what might it look like in the Echo, in my afterlife. It got to be kind of a bad habit. I be like out for date night with my wife, and I'd be sitting in a restaurant and be looking around and be like, well, it'd be really dark in here because there's no lights, there'd probably be no one in here, and I'd realize I'd completely neglected my end of the conversation
because you were imagining it.
Yeah. And then my wife would look over and she'd be like, you're thinking about the dead people again, aren't you?
Yeah, it's like a bad version of ghosts.
I'm right? Thinking about the dead people.
So that said, I do think it's an interesting thing that this is genre busting is a terrible word, but what kind of, I wonder if this book would have been, I wonder, first of all, how do you describe this? Because you've done a, you know, there's science fiction, and I wonder how hard it is for publishers if they feel like you're not in a specific category.
Yeah, it's a frustrating notion, genre as it relates to sales. I mean, for me, as a lifelong reader, there's two kinds of writing, you know, there's good and bad, and the goal is to just put everything you can into being on the good side of the equation. But genre is really, it's a sales tool, right? It's to tell you which aisles in the bookstore you don't want to walk down. It's not even the ones you do, really. It's the ones you don't. It's like, I don't go to the self-help aisle. I'm not that interested overall in the romance aisle. But the others are ones that I do go to. I don't know. To me, there is some frustration in crossing genre lines, but I think there's also enormous power in it. You know, I didn't set out to do a mashup. I set up to write the truest version that I could. And I think it's mostly being classified as a thriller, which is where I'd put it.
Well, and I also wonder, this probably, as a first-time author couldn't have probably, I wonder if a first-time author could have written something like this and gotten it published. Because it's kind of, but I feel like you're so prolific. You have a great following of people who enjoy your work already. Do you think it's easier to write something like this that's kind of genre busting if you're already an established author?
Possibly. I mean, I know I couldn't have written this as a first novel. This was my ninth and it nearly killed me. I rewrote the first 100 pages 9 times. There was so much balance and coordination that I wanted in it. That for me, I needed to, well, have 8 novels under my belt before I could attack it. I don't know. I guess I'm just a big believer in readers. I think readers will always respond to a good story forcefully told. And I think focusing on anything else is a little silly.
So Will and Claire are your central characters here. We touched on this in the beginning, that this really is a love story between the two of them. Why was it so important for you that that's such a strong thread throughout this all? That's really what ties this whole book together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. I mean, it goes back to the dream that gave birth to it. Was what made that potent was the idea of not being able to connect with the woman that I love. You know, and that's a very human and I think very universal fear and thought about death. Another thing that I wanted to do is we have this idea that when we die, we'll get all the answers, right? Either if you're a religious person, you'll land according to the tenets of your religion. If you're not, it'll be blackness, and that's an answer too. To me, it was fascinating to imagine, like, no, what if you died and you found yourself somewhere and you still didn't have any answers? And so you had to decide who you were going to be based on your your morals and your internal compass, and love plates back into that rather importantly. Is, you know, if you can love, if you can be with another person, then you're probably going to choose to be the right kind of person even there.
Are you a religious person? Have people been asking you this since you've written this? Uh-oh.
Yeah, no, I am not. I guess I'd fall into the more things in heaven and earth Horatio category, but no, I'm not.
I imagine you've probably been getting that question a lot. I want to go back to – I'm speaking with Marcus Seki, by the way. His latest book that's just out is called Afterlife. We've been talking about the novel. We've been talking about your readers. But you're also writing a screenplay for this.
Yeah.
How crazy is that? Is it
fairly
very
crazy.
Different?
Yeah.
Also?
Yeah. I spent a lot of time as a screenwriter hating the novelist.
It's thinking, why did this guy do this?
Why
really?
Did this guy do this to me? It's really enormous fun. I mean, it's kind of having a whole new set of colors on my palette.
What? But is it hard because when you're writing a screenplay, you have to put all of this into reality? Or is it hard? What's the hard thing about writing the screenplay, making this into a movie and writing this as a screenplay versus the book?
The hardest thing, and the reason most people will tell you the book is better than the movie in any case, is that the book's 300 or 400 pages long and the screenplay is 110, you know, with a lot of white space. You have to cut a lot, and you have to merge things, and you have to kind of wash it down to the essential truths of the story. And in the times where that's really well done, the movie still works great as a separate entity from the book. In the times where it's badly done and you make something up whole cloth or it just goes in a different direction, it's really frustrating too.
It must be really painful for you too, right? As the person who wrote the novel to then be the person who's going through and saying, we're got to cut this?
Yeah.
Is that really hard?
It is hard. I mean, there's a good bit of writing wisdom that is just in general is kill your darlings. In other words, don't get so attached to a paragraph.
Journalists say
page.
That all the time.
Kill your darlings.
The journalists say kill the baby, but kill your darling sounds a lot better.
Well, the thing is, I mean, to write a novel, I've already got a bathtub full of drowned darlings. I mean, I've already killed a lot of darlings. So these were the ones that survived, and now they're back in the Hunger Games.
Oh, wow.
It is hard. But honestly, it's also – I'm so grateful to have the opportunity I'm really enjoying the process.
And did it surprise you? Were there things you realized that weren't as important as you thought they were in the book now that you're doing the screenplay?
There are – what surprises me is realizing, even after all the time I spent on this book, that there are different ways to tell this story. You know, as you get into a book, you start to make decisions. You have to make decisions. If it's all options, it's all theory. So you start making decisions, and then those decisions become kind of the facts of the book for you. This is a fresh look at it, to just look at it again and be like, does it have to be that way? Can I tell the same story and lose this part and still have the same emotional resonance? Or can I change this character's motivation? It's been interesting to come back at it that way. And there's an upside too that I'm really excited about, is the kind of collaborative nature of this, is the idea that I can write this, and if I do it well, a first-rate actor or actress is going to be speaking these lines and putting it on their face and carrying the weight of a scene. I mean, that's pretty big help.
So I don't know what the time frame for this is, where obviously casting hasn't happened yet.
No, no.
Can I ask you who would you want to play Will and Claire in this? Do you have a dream?
Sure.
Who are your actors you have picked out who you'd love to have do this?
Well, I mean, I'll be clear that neither of them even knows this exists. But if Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt wanted to show up, they would be more than welcome in my version of the movie.
All right. I'm speaking with Marcus Seki. He's the author of Afterlife, soon to be a major motion picture.
Yeah, from Ron Howard.
All right, from Ron Howard. The book is out now. Marcus, thanks so much for being here with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Perhaps you've seen the blue "Hate Has No Home Here" posters and signs that have popped up all across Illinois, in houses of worship, on people's lawns, or in shop windows. Those signs saw renewed interest after the violence in Charlottesville. They were actually created by a small group of neighbors who came together in Chicago's North Park neighborhood. They've been getting requests from the signs, magnets, and window posters from not just towns across central Illinois like Champaign, but from as far away as Ecuador and Sweden. The group has ditched their initial Google form and built a website. They've raised more than $15,000, all to help their campaign, which started last fall. The original sign had 5 languages. Now it's available in nearly 36 that read, "Hate has no home here." They've spawned more than 130 individual campaigns in communities not just across the country, but the world. Today, we're revisiting our conversation with two of the campaign's many organizers. Carmen Rodriguez and Megan Trinter joined me in our Chicago studios in August. Carmen, Megan, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
So North Park, that's on the northwest side of Chicago. Who wants to tell me a little bit more about your neighborhood? Carmen? Oh, Carmen's looking at Megan. Go ahead, Megan.
Go ahead, Carmen. You got it.
I will take that one. So North Park is a kind of a pocketed community. It's closed in by some interesting barriers in that we have a campus at the west end, a couple of cemeteries thrown in there, and then a 64-acre nature preserve. So unless you know it's there, you don't know it's there. And it's made up of a very diverse community of people, ages, economics, cultures, languages. So it's got a unique composition.
And why is diversity and having your neighbors be proud of that so important to you guys in the neighborhood, Megan?
Well, I can say that I have 4 kids and they all go to the neighborhood school, and the neighborhood school is really representative of the diversity of the neighborhood in general. And so for me, I am in that neighborhood and we are participants in the things that go on in that neighborhood on purpose. And so I want to celebrate it. I want to acknowledge it. I want to acknowledge what that brings to my life and how that is great for me raising kids there and being a part of that community.
And Carmen, how did this "Hate Has No Home Here" campaign first get started? This isn't the first kind of things you guys have done as a neighborhood.
It isn't. And honestly, the current nature of the project is entirely accidental. Awesome, but accidental. Our community had multiple times come together to celebrate itself and to reassure itself after difficult things had happened. So after the Orlando shootings, we had gotten together and done kind of a similar, clearly much smaller scale project where we'd put up posters in our neighborhood that just said, "All are welcome, North Park neighbors." At a different point, we had put little ribbons on our stoops, and those were just ribbons for peace, kind of reminding everyone that our neighborhood welcomes everyone, accepts everyone, and is a peaceful place. We ended up putting ribbons all around the school. So in the fall of 2016, one of our neighbors, I think rather innocently, asked in the neighborhood Facebook group, "Hey, are we going to do anything to kind of address some of the hate speech and rhetoric that had been on the rise in the world, really, but a little bit in our neighborhood, too?" And that's really where this all kind of came together. We just thought we'd do another project, a little poster project.
So it came from a Facebook group. And did it come in response to a particular incident or just sort of general thoughts and feelings people had?
I mean, I think it's no secret that there was just a rise in tension last year. There was just a lot of...
You're talking about after the election?
No.
Before the election?
Before the election. Our conversation started well before the election. And we got it kind of together in the fall, but even before the election. So it wasn't necessarily election specific or politics specific. It was just in the air.
We posted pictures of what your logo looks like online on Twitter and Facebook. But Megan, can you describe for listeners what the "Hate Has No Home Here" logo and the posters look like?
Absolutely. "Hate Has No Home Here" is our slogan. And many of the posters, although there are a few variations, have the phrase "Hate Has No Home Here" listed in different languages, up to 5 different languages on the sign. And the logo itself is a heart, and it has the image of an American flag within it.
And where did that come from?
So the artwork was actually designed by one of our neighbors. The slogan came from the children of one of the people working on the project. And then we've had an additional designer working with us on some of the variations on the theme, including additional translations and different flags as the project has migrated outside the United States.
And the slogan, how did that come about? You said there were children in particular that came up with that?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, you know, this was as organic and as kind of loosely put together as a project could be when we were coming up with the idea for what our poster would be, kind of as the next wave of what are we doing in the neighborhood to address this. One of the women who was involved with the project from the beginning was talking about it in the car on the way to the zoo with her kids, a third grader and a kindergartner, and the kids were talking about it and came up between the two of them with that "Hate has no home here" message. She texted it to the rest of us who were working on this and said, "Hey, what do you guys think of this? I think it sounds good." And we said, "We think it sounds great. Let's go with that."
How do you guys, I don't know how close you are in terms of neighbors, Megan and Carmen. How would you say that the community is very close in terms of being very organized? Does a lot of this happen via social media? Does it happen in person?
I will argue that there's certainly a level of organization that happens between people that know they want to organize. So the neighborhood Facebook page is very active. And within that, there are some ties between us. We all have kids. We all know each other's values. And we also know that many of the people that started on the group and that are still on the committee are people that will get things done.
And so Get Things Done, you guys started this as like a grassroots, fill out this Google form if you want this poster. And now you all, Carmen, can you give us a sense of the volume of requests you're getting and where they're coming from?
So I think if folks are really interested to see how big this has gotten, we actually have a map on our website, which shows not just places where individual projects are, but just places where posters and signs have been cited. We have the project going in dozens of places in Illinois, way more than that in the United States. We are in Ecuador, Australia, Sweden, Germany. We just had a request for the EU and Canada. So it's definitely bigger than the original 500 posters we were planning on.
So you guys are originally planning on 500 posters. Who was going to print that?
We were thinking really big on those 500 posters, actually. So we have an organization in the neighborhood that is affiliated with one of the faith-based groups that has a presence in the neighborhood, and they were able to do the printing for us at cost of the posters. And then ultimately we ended up going to a local printer in the community who actually now is an active member of the group. They were so inspired by it. And they've also done a lot of printing for some of the other satellite groups that have started in the Chicago area.
And then so you now have a website. You've raised more than $15,000 on GoFundMe. What is that money for?
Well, originally, when we started a GoFundMe, one of the original members of the group said, "I'll start a GoFundMe to see if we can get some money to print these signs." And I think we started asking for $600, maybe $800.
Big bucks.
And
like the 500 signs.
Yeah. We were thinking really big there.
And the demand became so high that we raised that. And so every dollar that comes in goes back into printing yard signs and posters and making them available for free to the people that come to us. And I'll just mention that the $15,000 is just with our North Park group. Every other campaign leader that has started in Illinois, there are approximately 15 in the greater Chicagoland area, and then in every other state, raises their own money in whatever way they deem necessary.
And so how many different satellite groups do you guys have now? You're not even keeping track? So you guys are...
I'm terrible. You know, each one of us has kind of a role and a responsibility in the group. So one of our other project members is the person responsible for dropping all those pins on our map. And I know that she knows that number really well. At last count, it was 43, but I'm sure it's way bigger
43
than that.
Satellite groups.
Yep.
And why are satellite groups important to you guys? Why aren't you guys just doing it all yourselves?
So this is actually the whole point, because for us, the point was in our neighborhood to make our neighbors feel safe, to make our neighbors feel welcome, so that when somebody was walking down the street, they didn't see someone who looked different from them and think to themselves, oh, this person probably hates me. Instead, they would walk down the street, see the "Hate Has No Home Here" sign, and realize whatever is different about me from this person doesn't hate me. So it was super important to us when we saw this project growing to make sure that other communities had the opportunity to express that in the way that made sense for their community and that caused them to have those conversations themselves. So when we went to our local printer and showed him this sign and said, hey, we need these and can you do this for us, that led to a conversation about how his family came to this country, how afraid his parents were when some of this rhetoric had started building up, and how relieved he was to see our neighborhood sending this message out to one another. We've gotten so many stories like that about different experiences that people are having all over the country and, as it turns out, in other countries, because it's the human connection that is so important.
I would think there are probably very few people who haven't been disturbed by the events in Charlottesville and people who are disheartened. And I wonder for you guys, how has being part of this Hate Has No Home Here campaign changed the way you all view tragedies like what happened in Charlottesville?
I will speak for myself and say that Hate Has No Home Here has become this opportunity for me to literally put a stake in the ground to say how I feel about our country, how I feel about the people within my community, how I feel about the diversity and the people that I live near and with. And so when something like Charlottesville happens, I'm reminded that a sign is a wonderful way to express that to the people around me, but that there's more to do. And I certainly am reminded of how important it is for everybody when we have, after Charlottesville, people emailing us, Facebook messaging us. People want to make that message clear to their communities as well.
Carmen?
Yeah, I would say to that that it's unfortunate that we have to be so useful, but I'm grateful that we're so useful to so many people. This last week, I was actually driving across the country to drop my daughter off at school. So it was kind of an interesting experience to be traveling across the country at the same time that my phone was just blowing up with phone calls with people asking how they could get involved, how they could participate, how they could share this message, because it's the ugliness is not the only thing that's out there. And I think that was so important for us when we started this, and it continues to be important for people not to just hear ugly messages and hatred. It's really important for people to hear that a lot of people believe in goodness, in kindness, in respect, and in civil discourse. And that's what this project does. It gives everybody a chance to feel like they're not alone when they are rejecting hate.
That said, people who are listening, how can they get a sign of their own? How can they get involved if they want to?
So first things first, we'd like them to go to the website. It's www.hatehasnohomehere.org. The artwork is downloadable for free. We do have some usage guidelines on there and ask everyone to please respect those usage guidelines. There's also information there on how to either print for yourself, take to a local printer, or if you're so inspired, start your own project in your neighborhood, in your community, and in whatever way you're able to, we encourage people to share that message. Just want to make sure we give credit to everybody who participated. This was definitely and continues to be a group effort. There's no one person in charge or anything like that. And that has been really super cool, that it's all been kind of like this equal measure of people giving their talents.
That's Carmen Rodriguez and Megan Trinter, both of them two neighbors who are volunteers as part of the Hate Has No Home Here campaign, which started in the Chicago neighborhood of North Park and, as they've been telling us, has spread all over the world. Carmen, Megan, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, if you'd like to send us an email, if you want to follow us on social media, all of that information is at our website,
21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. Search for our Facebook page, Like the 21st. You can comment there, too, on what we're working on or post questions or comments that you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Bob Holly and Alan Montecilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Morg. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance of the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from the Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.